right, good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. For the record, it's 1:30 p.m. on Thursday, February 13th, 2020. We're in the Belch Room of the Thomas Stewart Building. We have a quorum to do business. Present today are Senator Stevens, Senator Costello, Senator Rivack. Senator Gray Jackson is away and will not be with us today. I'd like to recognize, and myself, Senator Bishop, I'd like to recognize Kari Cooper-Reiter, Mr. Bridges, and Cody Grusendorf from my office. Today we have one item on the agenda, and that's a presentation from Legislative Legal, Dan Wayne. And thank you for that. And our Senate President, Kathy Giesel's in the room, as former Commissioner of Labor is also in the room. Heidi Dragas, how you doing? All right, Mr. Wayne, let's see. This is going to start. So we're starting a series of hearings on this Alaska Hire topic, and we will have we're going to have a overview today of Alaska laws that are currently in statute. And throughout these hearings, we'll get a thorough understanding of how the law was crafted and what exactly it does and how it was enforced. So with that being said, today is informational. Members, if you want to ask questions, you know, at the end of each slide, that's fine with you, Mr. Wayne. If you got questions, I'd like to do that. And please proceed, put yourself on the record. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dan Wayne. I'm a legislative legal counsel with Legislative Legal.
Excuse me, before you do that, Senator Gray Jackson, she made a liar out of me. She did show up. She is better.
Yeah.
Good. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we are a full complement today.
So first, I want to draw your attention to the title of this presentation. Because the history of Alaska Hire is so vast, I decided to focus on the controversial moments in that history. There's an awful lot of cases and reading and newspaper accounts and so forth, legislative history, but I'm just trying to focus on the controversial moments, which are mostly involved court cases. Some of those moments are listed here, beginning with Hicklin v. Orbeck, a case that was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1978, which is also the year I graduated from Wrangell High School. But before going back that far, let's take a look at what's happening today.
So just as a footnote, so you graduated high school in Wrangell in 1968?
78.
Yes, okay. Mr. Chairman. Because I was spent a year in Wrangell in 1968.
Yeah, that was,
all right.
I think I was in Anchorage that year.
Okay.
In any event, after about a 30-year period of quiet, Alaska Hire is having a controversial moment now. A lawsuit was filed in 2019 alleging that the law is unconstitutional. The state of Alaska chose not to defend the constitutionality of Alaska Hire and settled that case. The Attorney General explained in a letter to Senator Giesel last fall, you can see some of the reasons that were given for why the law couldn't be defended on your screen. The Attorney General also explained his decision in an October 3rd, 2019 opinion and gave two main legal reasons, I think, for the decision. The case State v. Ensearch from 1989 and the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the Federal Constitution. So let's take a look at the first reason, the Ensearch case. It's important to know, starting out, that the Ensearch case was not a challenge to the current version of Alaska Hire. It was a challenge to AS 3610-160, which was a and not to 3610.150, which is the current version of Alaska Hire. 160 was a statute authorizing the Commissioner of Labor to determine economically distressed zones within the state and require a hiring preference for residents of those zones on certain projects. And the NSERCH court focused on how that caused discrimination between residents of one region of the state and residents of other regions of the state. The NSERCH court said that discrimination between groups of state residents based on what part of the state they lived in violated the state equal protection clause. The state equal protection clause is found in Article 1, Section 1 of our Constitution, and it guarantees all persons are equal and entitled to equal rights, opportunities, and protection under the law. Since NSERCH decided that case, that guarantee is pretty good protection against residential hiring preference laws that discriminate between groups of state residents. But that same year, the voters of Alaska amended our state constitution in an effort to remove the equal protection guarantee as a barrier to discrimination against non-residents. And on your screen, you'll see the new part of the constitution that passed in 1989, I believe. This amendment was designed to create a path around the state's constitutional equal protection guarantee for the current version of Alaska Hire, which is AS 3610.150. That became law in 1986, and it's still in effect. That's what we call Alaska Hire today. And remember, as we just discussed, that the Attorney General's recent conclusion about Alaska Hire leans pretty heavily on the NSERCH case for support. But the NSERCH decision threw out 3610.160, not 150, and they threw it out based on an equal protection argument. So it's difficult to say how much of an impact the holding in the NSERCH decision would have on litigation over current Alaska Hire, the 3610.150. The other main reason cited by the Attorney General in support of his October decision is the Privileges and Immunities Clause, and that is still a very valid concern when we talk about the current version of Alaska Hire. That clause bars discrimination against citizens of other states unless there's a substantial reason for it, and that whether or not a reason is substantial enough is left up to courts to decide in a given case depending on the circumstances that are brought before it. In 1948, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case that did not involve Alaska, came up with a test for what kind of residential preference law might be enacted by a state and be able to withstand a legal challenge based on the Privileges and Immunities Clause. 30 years later, in 1978, the U.S. Supreme Court applied that test to the first Alaska Hire case. In that case, which was Hicklin v. Orbeck, the case applied this test that you see on your screen this is referred to as the Toomer test. They applied it to a statute that required a residential hiring preference for jobs connected with the oil and gas industry in Alaska. So it wasn't really anything like the current version of Alaska Hire. It was a really broadly reaching provision that the court interpreted as saying that any job in Alaska remotely connected with the extraction of oil and gas from our state would be subject to a resident hire preference.
And with that being said, and that was struck down by the Supreme Court.
Right? It was.
All right. So the current law that we're under right now, that doesn't encompass or capture the oil and gas on the North Slope.
It's difficult to see how it could. The current law is limited to application to public construction projects. I suppose if the state were the owner of oil and gas and we're going to construct something in connection with that, that might be considered a public construction project.
And for the committees, we're going to have further in weeks forthcoming, we're going to have we're starting here with the history, then we're going to go down with wage and hour, research and analysis, et cetera, to walk us completely through this whole process of how we got to where we are today with the law. And a lot of this other stuff we can tease out. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you help me understand the tumor test? Is that something still in effect?
Well,
something you deal with?
It's summarized on your screen here. It was summarized by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Hicklin case. And so, first of all, you have to show that there's a substantial reason for the resident hire preference. And then you have to show that there's evidence that the non-residents, as a class, constitute a peculiar source of the problem at which the discriminatory statute is aimed. And then, even if you can show that, there has to be a reasonable relationship between the danger represented by that by non-residents as a group, as a class, and the discrimination that's being practiced on them by the law. Does that answer your question?
Clear as mud. Thank you.
Okay. I thought so. This is kind of complicated, and one of the things that complicates it is some of the language used in the older cases when they talk about, you know, particular source of the evil. You know, what does that mean? And I interpret evil, and I think other courts have too, or other lawyers have as well, to mean problem. And the word evil just kind of, you know, takes a long time to get comfortable with. But I think the meaning of it just means problem. So in Hicklin v. Orbeck, when they applied this tumor test, the results were not good. You'll see on screen here, the court was critical of the oil and gas industry residential hiring preference because there was no evidence on the record to support a finding that the non-residents that the law discriminated against were the particular cause of Alaska's high unemployment rate, which they said was the evil that the problem that the law was aimed at was high unemployment. Let's get rid of it. Let's have a law saying we're going to hire only residents or mostly residents for these jobs. Here I should warn you that the next few quotes from Hicklin contain some racist language. And I've left these quotes intact because I think that they help illustrate that a little bit about what the world was like in 1978 and how the U.S. Supreme Court might not have had a very good understanding of Alaska, our culture, and the people who live here. I'll go ahead and hit you with the first one here.
This is the court's words.
This is the court's words. Yeah, I should want to clarify that. It's not
U.S. Supreme Court.
Right.
Verbiage.
Not the committee. It's not me. I did add some underlining, and I took out some footnotes and so forth. But this is what they said. And here again, they're critical of the absence of evidence in the record supporting the oil and gas industry residential preference law. And one way to interpret their unhappiness about that is that the court concluded, based on what evidence was available to it then, that high unemployment in Alaska was caused by the resident workers themselves because they did not have the right training or live in the right part of the state. You know, I mean, that's probably a harsh way to look at this decision, but you could say, well, wait a minute, it kind of seems like they're just blaming the unemployed people for not getting jobs.
You know, just to put another footnote on this, this was the Supreme Court's opinion in 1978, and mm-hmm. at one time I had done quite a bit of reading in this area on Alaska Hire, and it wasn't just a phenomenon that came about for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, because that's what we're talking about here in 1978 with the Hicklin v. Orbeck decision. It goes clear back into, and I used some of this information in committee when I was commissioner, when we were defending the project labor agreement language in the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act. And this goes clear back to World War II. Fairbanks, Ladd Field, Fort Rich in Anchorage, the buildup of our military assets in the state. And there was a hue and cry from the residents of Alaska then that they were the last ones hired, the first ones laid off, coming mm-hmm. influx of a non-resident workforce. And they were, you know, wanting to go to work like all the rest of us that live here on a job. So then fast forward to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and that's what we're talking about.
Well, it certainly seems true that if the employers from in-state and out-of-state in 1978 had the dim view of the qualifications of Alaska residents that the Supreme Court has in Hicklin, that, you know, they would probably follow some kind of policy like that. You know, well, those are the least desirable workers. Let's get rid of them as soon as we can. But I shouldn't editorialize. It's too dangerous. Like I said, the court was pretty hard on some of our people. Let's see in this next slide. It's possible that 36 years later, in 2020, that they would lay less of the blame for Alaska's high unemployment rate on the unemployed persons themselves. But the important takeaway from this quote isn't the racially insensitive language, culturally insensitive language. It's that in order for Alaska Hire in its current version to withstand a court challenge based on the Privileges and Immunities Clause, the state would have to show a strong link between the law's discrimination against non-residents and the problem the non-residents present. In other words, the state would have to show that the resident hire preference law is not too broad, that it's closely tailored to fix the problems that it's aimed at. After the Hicklin case, the legislature enacted an early and flawed version of what we now know as Alaska Hire. I believe it was in 1983, or it could have been earlier than that. Maybe it was amended in 1983, but that law was soon challenged and declared unconstitutional. But before we get into that, I want to tell you about how the U.S. Supreme Court took up and decided a case outside of Alaska, another resident hire case in another state. And this case is United Building and Construction Trades Council v. Camden. It's a 1984 U.S. Supreme Court case. Or, I'm sorry, 1985 U.S. Supreme Court case. The court considered a challenge of a resident hiring preference for city public works jobs that favored residents of Camden, the city of Camden, over residents from outside of Camden. Camden's in New Jersey. It's interesting to think for a second about the difference between the circumstances in New Jersey and the circumstances here. For one thing, you know, New Jersey is surrounded by states that are full of qualified workers that can drive into the city of Camden and work each day and then drive home to whatever state they're from at night. And we don't really have that situation here. I suppose people could fly up from down south on a daily basis, but it's not really very practical. So the city of Camden, you know, was really under assault by out-of-state, out-of-city workers who wanted those jobs. They were government jobs. And but I think the important takeaway from this quote is that the U.S. Supreme Court, and I've underlined it here, emphasized that every inquiry under the Privileges and Immunities Clause must be conducted with due regard for the principle that the states should have considerable leeway in analyzing local evils, local problems, and in prescribing appropriate cures. If you see that, if you're a legislator in 1986 and you're coming in and saying, well, let's fix this resident hire law, you know, what can we do? Well, you know, maybe we can't do anything. Well, wait, the court in Camden just last year says that we have this leeway. Let's figure out what our local problems are, and then let's prescribe a fix. So this seems to indicate that, you could read it more narrowly, but I think it indicates that the Privileges and Immunities Clause is not an absolute bar to a residential hiring preference in the right circumstances. One of those circumstances, the court seems to say here in this quote from Camden, is a preference limited to hiring for jobs on public works projects.
So the Camden court, was this the state court or was this in the Supreme Court?
Oh, this was the U.S. Supreme Court, okay. Yeah. I'm so sorry, I didn't have a cite on screen.
Back up a page.
Okay.
So, and it's giving you, that the court saying, with due regard, that states should have considerable leeway.
Right. The U.S. Supreme Court said that. And don't forget, this is the same court that just, I believe, in 1984 decided the, 1978 decided the Hicklin case,
right.
And made it sound like the Privileges and Immunities Clause was almost an insurmountable barrier to resident hire preference. I mean, they theorized that it was possible, but they made it sound like a pretty tough mountain to climb. There wasn't a lot of encouraging stuff in that case. And now in 1985, they're saying, you know, states need to have this leeway because they have to govern. And every state has different problems and those sorts of things. So is it all right if I move on to the next slide, Mr. Chairman?
So then I'm just tying it together with the underlined on the page you're on now.
So I underlined the part here about the city public works projects. That seems to show that the court felt like that was the kind of circumstance that might make a difference in whether or not a residential preference, hiring preference statute is constitutional or not. And up above, the court refers back to the first Alaska hire case, Hicklin v. Orbeck, and it distinguishes that case, which had to do with the overly broad oil and gas residential preference hiring law, with the Camden law, which only dealt with city public works projects in Camden.
Because they narrowly construed in Camden the Supreme's bulleted line. Versus Hicklin versus Orbeck, where we were going for the kitchen sink.
Right, exactly.
And in this decision, mm-hmm. we narrowed it to public works. The court did.
The oil and gas hiring preference law was, you know, really broad. Mm-hmm. And so now we come up on the Robeson case in 1986. This is an Alaska Supreme Court case. It was 8 years after Hicklin v. Orbeck, 1 year after Camden. It's the first Alaska hire case. I'm sorry, it's the second Alaska hire case. In this case, the Department of Labor Commissioner James Robeson was named in a suit over the 1983 version of Alaska Hire. And that's how the case got its name. So that version, like the current version of Alaska Hire, discriminated against non-residents of Alaska by giving residents a hiring preference on public construction projects. The state defended the 1983 version of Alaska Hire and lost. And I guess I'll take a second to talk about the word discrimination. You know, we've all grown up hearing it, and it has kind of a pejorative connotation in our minds. We think of it as, you know, discrimination is bad. And most of us are thinking of the kinds of discrimination that are illegal now against, you know, people who are marginalized in our society for one reason or another, or have, you know, special challenges, or, you know, they look different than the majority, whatever it is. But not all discrimination is necessarily bad, and not all discrimination is illegal. The kind of discrimination that lawyers advise people to avoid is illegal discrimination, unlawful discrimination. And so when a court looks at a law and says, well, you know, this discriminates against people outside of the city of Camden, but, and it, you know, it's not necessarily a violation of the Privileges and Immunities Clause, even though it does discriminate. And, you know, the goal, I suppose, in defending Alaska Hire would be to, first of all, you don't go in saying this law doesn't discriminate, because of course it does. You're saying if you live outside of state, you don't have as good of a chance of getting this job as someone who lives in the state who qualifies for this hiring preference, and we'll get to that in a minute. But the job would be to convince the court that the new law measures up and answers all the concerns raised in previous cases. And that's a pretty big task, but it may not be impossible. Here's a little bit more about the Robeson case. In that case, they said that it violated the Privileges and Immunities Clause, that the Alaska Hire, the 1983 version of it, violated the Privileges and Immunities Clause. The ruling was based on the tumor test that we talked about earlier, that was developed in 1948 by the U.S. Supreme Court, and then this fine-tuned by the court in 1978 in Hicklin. And that language is probably starting to look a little familiar. If you look at the screen, it looks like some language we saw earlier. And the takeaway from this slide is, I think, is that a court will find that a law aimed simply at lowering the unemployment rate by hiring more residents is unconstitutional, because that goal by itself does not justify discriminating against a fundamental constitutional right of residents to ply their trade in any state they choose. And that's the right guaranteed by the Privileges and Immunities Clause.
Senator Stevens.
Could you explain that there's a 1983 and a 1986, both called the Robeson version.
Okay.
What's going on there? Is it a separate lawsuit?
Okay. You're talking about the title on the slide at the bottom? Robeson, Alaska Hire, in the 1983 version. What I meant by that, and I can see how it could be confusing, is it's referring to the 1983 version of Alaska Hire.
Okay, so not two court cases.
No, it's one court case, but still talking about it. Because the term Alaska Hire is used so much in this presentation, and it's so, you know, widely used throughout the state, I'm trying to distinguish between the different versions, and maybe I'll work on a better way of doing that. Here the court in Robeson sort of, you know, reconfirms the reason that the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the oil and gas industry hiring preference law in 1978 as being too broad. But this quote also underscores a big concern of the Alaska Supreme Court regarding the 1983 version of Alaska Hire, and that was that that version gave a hiring preference that was too broad because it was not need-based. It gave preferential treatment to residents who do not need it. So, after Robeson, the legislature went back to the drawing board. And, you know, I've looked at the record from 1986 in the legislative files, and I could see that the legislature and the Department of Law worked together in that year, 1986, to fix the flaws that the Robeson Court had identified, at least to try to. And so I should probably take a minute to mention that our legislative librarians have done a terrific job of putting together an electronic database of the legislative bill files from the 1986 session, and it's available online. And I put the site on this slide, but you're probably already lamenting the fact that it's not in your packet. It's because I added it late. I forgot to add it earlier. But you can call the library, and they'll be happy to set you up and get you connected if you want to look at that. It's a huge file, but it's pretty interesting. And another thing that will probably, you may be struck as I was, but how similar things were done then as they are now. It's the same process. It just, some of the fonts look different and the and so forth, but the legislative process is very similar now to what it was then. I think that when you look at it, it gives the appearance or supports the conclusion that the Alaska legislature, you know, tried really hard to, you know, put on the record in the hearings on the various bills that led up to the final.
Keep going.
They worked really hard at trying to identify the problems that they were trying to address with local hire law. They didn't just say, oh, here's an unemployment rate in Alaska, here's the unemployment rate in the nation. We want these to look more the same, so let's pass a law. They had all kinds of expert testimony about social problems in different parts of our state, that many that are attributable to poverty. And so they, you know, various experts come in and testify, and there's copies of their reports that were added into the record. And so it would be difficult for a court to come in and look at that record and say, well, this law was, you know, just had there's just an inadequate record that it was aimed at anything other than just economic protectionism, you know, which is something that we don't allow. Laws that the residential hiring preference laws that are just for the purpose of economic protectionism. It has to be for something, some other kind of problem being addressed. And they also tried to construct a law that would be, that addressed some of the concerns raised by the courts, you know, so it wasn't, tried to make it so it wasn't too broad, that it was need-based.
So,
I went back to that slide.
The legislature worked with the administration, Department of Law, and the Attorney General to craft the law we have today.
You know, someone who was present in 1986 in that process might paint a different picture, but the record shows that they did. There's correspondence between the Department of Law and various legislators and committees. If I remember right, the Attorney General at the time was Ron Lawrenson, and he, you know, started out initially by helping the legislature identify what legal problems needed to be fixed and the kind of things that might lead to their being fixed. He commented on various versions of various language and various versions of the law that were put forth in the House and the Senate. And ultimately, it was his opinion that the law that they adopted was, had a good chance of withstanding a
constitutional challenge.
And somewhere in that record, and I couldn't find it, I wanted to make a slide out of it. But somewhere in that record, there's something in writing from him that says that.
Okay.
So, is it all right if I move on to the next slide, Mr. Chairman?
Well, let's see. So everybody's clear. on the so this zone of underemployment that we're talking about here, he's moved off the slide. But if you go back one, we're going to have research and analysis come is going to be before the committee, and they're going to walk us through how they calculate zones of underemployment. So
okay, well, there's another slide or two that has to do with that, I think. But let's see here, maybe. Okay, here we go. So this, what I've done, and I've put together three slides that I tried to boil down and summarize AS 3610-150. And I hopefully I didn't miss anything big in doing that, but I wanted it to fit on a slide. And so except for 3610-160, which was found unconstitutional in the EnSearch case, the law that the legislature created in 1986 has survived for more than 30 years. Under 3610-150, the current law, several commissioners of labor and workforce development, including Commissioner Ledbetter, have issued determinations that Alaska is a zone of underemployment. And I think it's important to note that each zone of underemployment is only lasts for 2 years. So it seems like that might be something that's attractive to a court who is, you know, trying to determine whether or not the Alaska Hire is tied to a, you know, tied to conditions on the ground rather than just sort of a law of general applicability, is that, you know, circumstances could change it. Maybe the next time, I believe the last determination was in June of 2019, maybe the next one, if there is one, maybe they'll skip it and say, well, gosh, times are good here, and we don't have some of the same conditions that we had before.
In that case, the law would not be enforced because it's not applicable.
Right, because there wouldn't be a determination of a zone unless the commissioner determines that it's needed based on these criteria. And the other thing that happens is each time a determination is made, you know, yes, it's statewide, but it's there's other things that might be different in each one. They list out the jobs that it applies to on a craft by craft or occupational basis. So if you look at these past declarations or determinations, the lists look a little different on each one. And that's probably, you know, people at the Department of Labor studying all kinds of charts and graphs, figuring out, you know, where are the, you know, how many trained workers do we have in these occupations? Where's the need for employment? And, you know, speaking of, okay, yeah, here we go. I skipped a page in my notes. So the commissioner looks at the nature of the work, the classification of the workers, and the number of qualified residents available. And that changes from day to day and from year to year and 2 year period to 2 year period. So it's kind of a rolling, flexible thing. And then speaking of qualifying, residents must qualify under 3610-140. There's a cross-reference in 150 that says that, you know, the direction to this other statute says, you know, here's what you have to qualify. And you qualify by in several different ways. This is a list of ors, not ands. You know, receiving unemployment benefits, you're eligible to receive unemployment, but your benefits ran out. You're unemployed, but you're registered to find work. You're underemployed or marginally employed. Or you completed approved job training, but you're still unemployed or underemployed. So it's important from the standpoint of surviving future legal challenges that the current version of Alaska Hire established a less broad hiring preference. And then that it's based on whatever circumstances exist at the time of a determination is made, and that the new law is need-based and also takes into consideration job training. So that's the current law. As far as the legal shape that it's in now, except for the NSEARCH case, it hasn't been challenged in court until 2019. And it was challenged, and the state elected not to defend the constitutionality of Alaska Hire in court and settled the case. And so they did that before a court, you know, without the court saying whether or not the law was constitutional or not. So is it unconstitutional, I guess, is the question, as far as, you know, where the law's at right now. We're at the end of the history of the law, at this, you know, the tail end of it here, the current end. Is it constitutional? It's kind of the question of the day. And the answer really isn't known. Only a court can give that answer definitively. People can have opinions about it, but a court decides. Until a court decides that it's unconstitutional, it's still, you know, quote, good law. It's still in effect. And so that's where we're at. And that's the end of my presentation.
Questions? Good. All right. Well, thank you for the presentation. And we will, we're not, I mean, for me in this committee, I think we need to have a good, thorough understanding, and starting with the history lesson from the beginning to the first challenge to where we are here today. The jury's still out. Maybe yes, maybe no. As we have subsequent meetings, and I think hopefully you'll get a better understanding of why we have the laws if you don't already have them. And thank you for your effort into this. And
thank
I'm going to ask, you have that website or the
citation?
No, the records that the clerks, you said the history lesson is really good and it's very comprehensive.
Yeah,
so
let's go back here. It's on your screen on this one slide. Somewhere.
Cody's got it. That's all I need.
Cody has it? Okay. Yeah. So Cody has it, and the library has it. You can email them or call them, and if you email it, they'll send it to you in email, and you have it. You can copy it and paste it and send it to your friends. It's public. It's not private in-house stuff. It's all public information. Or it wouldn't be on there.
Yeah. Well, and thank you. And, the big takeaway for me is from that is that both the legislature and the administration, the Attorney General's office, worked to craft the law we have today. And
it appears that way to me.
Yep. Okay, thank you. Seeing no further comments and no questions out of this very stoic group today, I guess we will adjourn, and we're going to come back here on Thursday, and no. Tuesday, we're gonna SB 172 to extend the state medical board. It's an extension for the state medical board. We have five confirmation Q&As coming up, and that's our Tuesday schedule. Then on Thursday next week, we're gonna have wage and hours going to be here from the Department of Labor. Title 36, that's all our public construction guidelines and wage schedules for public construction projects, and that's where this Alaska Hire law is in the statute, and we're going to start with wage and hour next Thursday. So with that, seeing no other comments, we are adjourned at 2:15. Thank you.